This is Love Your Work. On this show, we help you make it as a creative entrepreneur. I am David Cadavy. I have been a solopreneur for more than 10 years. I'm an international award-winning designer. I have written a bunch of best-selling books, including Design for Hackers and The Heart to Start. From Love Your Work headquarters in Colombia, yes, the country, I have interviewed titans of industry like Steve Case. I've interviewed best-selling authors like Seth Godin and James Altucher. I've interviewed experts on behavioral science, creators from dancers to a chef to a Hollywood set designer, visionaries on the cutting edge of creative monetization, whether that is self-publishing or blockchain technology. And from these conversations, I pull out lessons to share with you on how you can find your unique voice as a creative entrepreneur, how you can nail the right mindset to succeed, how you can be the first to capitalize on new opportunities to make a living making your art. So if you are new here, welcome. Again, I am David Cadavy. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, please hit subscribe on your podcast app and get my free creative productivity toolkit. Sign up at cadavy.net/tools. One of the key themes that we've been exploring here on Love Your Work over the past 3 years has been just how it is that creators get paid. This was certainly on the top of my mind when I doubled down on writing and podcasting and I moved down to Colombia with really no clear business model in sight. So to understand how creators get paid, we need to understand the entire economy of content. How does content get monetized? How much or how little of that monetization makes it to creators? And we have talked about the economics of content and how they shape technology in my essay on the behavioral revolution. We have talked about how those economics promote digital distraction in conversations with Hooked author Nir Eyal. We have talked about new models for monetization, such as cryptocurrency-based compensation with Steemit CEO Ned Scott and with Manish Sethi from Pavlok. And today we are going to dig into privacy. When you understand how your privacy is being invaded to keep the web running, it starts to really become more clear just where things will be going in the future and what you can do both as a creator and as a consumer of content to make that a bright future for yourself and your fellow creator. So today I'm talking to BJ Mendelson, author of Privacy and How to Get It Back. In this conversation, we are going to learn, what are the ways that our privacy is being invaded to keep the web running? And why does it matter? And what can you do to protect your privacy and encourage companies to search for other ways to monetize? And is the online advertising industry in for a day of reckoning? What trends should you as a creative entrepreneur be aware of? Now, speaking of new models for monetization, we have reached a new milestone in the life of Love Your Work. And this is really huge. Love Your Work is now fully listener supported. I told you it was huge. Can you believe it? Our Patreon backing has reached the level where it now covers all post-production, all hosting of the audio files, all publishing assistance that I use to get this show to you every Thursday like clockwork. Yes, it is big. Very, very big. And so a huge, huge thank you to all of you Patreon supporters out there. Thank you to our newest members, Mike Naughton, Edlin Nguyen, and Vitas Pinkovicius. Vitas, by the way, is backing at the $25 a month level, so you are going to start hearing his name added to the top supporters in the closing credits. And Vitas says, I hope you will continue to grow your audience because it's truly one of the best in the world for creative solopreneurs on the level of what Tim Ferriss or James Altucher are doing. Specifically for me as the creator of Secrets of Organ Playing and Pinky and Spiky comic strips, you give me endless amounts of inspiration. Please don't stop. So, Vitas, it is a huge, huge honor to have even one person compare this show to the podcasts of Tim Ferriss and James Altucher because those happen to be the exact two podcasts that inspired me to start this podcast almost 3 years ago now. I only hope that this show has grown to start to have its own personality and voice. So just because the production costs are fully listener supported doesn't mean that I don't still need your help. So I've been on sort of an austerity plan with this podcast for the past year or so. I haven't bought any new equipment. I did get lucky. I won some equipment. That was a wonderful windfall. So this year I have had to skip the podcast movement conference. The conference was really enjoyable. It was really valuable. But I had to ask myself, you know, how valuable is it? I just couldn't really justify the expense this year. So if you've been reading my income reports over on Kadavy.net, you know what's up. Really exciting things are happening. It's just taking time, as many good things do. And of course, there is my Colombian visa situation. So as you listen to this, I am in Cusco, Peru. I'm calling it my temporary exile. Basically, in order to have enough days left on my tourist stamp to apply for a visa again, I had to skedaddle. I had to leave the country for a couple of weeks, a little unplanned vacation, a little unplanned adventure. So if you want to follow along with me on my temporary exile, I'll be keeping you up to date over on Instagram. I'm at Kadavy over there. I'll even be making a trip to Machu Picchu, so there'll be some updates of that. So again, follow me on at Kadavy on Instagram. So thank you again to our amazing Patreon supporters. I hope that this is just the beginning. You have taken us to this level. Now let's take it even higher. So if you'd like to be amongst the few, the proud, the Patreon supporters, just go to kadavy.net/donate. That is kadavy.net/donate. By the way, is donate the right word for it? I had somebody message me saying that they thought that support would be a better word for it. But then I thought, well, but also kadavy.net/support could be for support on, you know, courses or something like that, which don't necessarily exist on kadavy.net anyway. But I don't know. It's a little bit of a mix up. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. Let me know what you think. Is it donating? Is it supporting? Is it some other thing? Anyway, next up, I'm super proud to have this new sponsor of the show. The sponsor is Backblaze, because I know that Backblaze is really going to save the butt of somebody out there. And so I'm happy about that. So imagine that you tried to start up your computer tomorrow and your hard drive had failed and everything is gone. I mean, everything. Would you have a plan for that? Most of us have some documents on the cloud, but that is definitely not a backup plan. What about everything else? What about redundancy? How long would it take you to get back up to speed? So I'm going to tell you more later about how Backblaze can have you back up and running fast. The only catch is that you have to actually be a Backblaze customer in order for them to save you. So for now, go to backblaze.com/loveyourwork. Get their fully featured 15-day free trial. That is backblaze.com/loveyourwork. And I am doing a cool promo swap with my friends over at rocketship.fm. Now, if you like Love Your Work, I think you're really going to like rocketship.fm. If you like rocketship.fm, you're probably going to like Love Your Work, which is why we're doing the swap. So I know a lot of you are working really hard. You're building things. And my friends over at rocketship.fm have a show that I think you're really going to love. They just launched their fifth season. They'll be following three different entrepreneurs, showing you their progress every step of the way. One of them is a solopreneur. Another runs a 350-person globally distributed company. Another just raised $18 million in their Series C round, and that person is scaling up. So you're going to hear not only about these entrepreneurs' business struggles, but also about their personal struggles, such as how it is that they deal with pressure from family and loved ones. So if you are building a company or you're just thinking about building something, listen to rocketship.fm. They have amazing production quality, amazing storytelling. They're right up there with your favorites from NPR. It's one of those narrative formats rather than this being kind of an interview format. So just search for rocketship.fm in your favorite podcast app. Catch their new fifth season. Okay, here is BJ Mendelsohn. I am here with BJ Mendelsohn, author of Privacy and How to Get It Back. BJ, thanks for coming on the show. I always ask people who go through the work of writing a book, what was it that you think made you so interested in this topic of privacy that you felt motivated to write a book about it?
Yeah, I think it really spun out my first book, which was Social Media is Bullshit from St. Martin's Press. The privacy thing kept coming up over and over and over again in the research, but I found I couldn't get to it in the first book. Like, it was too far of a, it was a related topic, but it also just took me too far off the path of talking about how these tools don't really work the way we would like them to for creatives and different people. So I put all the privacy stuff aside and was like, okay, I think that, you know, this is something we really need to revisit. And I was just lucky with the timing, because not long after the book came out, you know, you had the whole thing with Zuckerberg and Russia and him going up and testifying before Congress.
Yeah, so it sounds like your first book kind of had a baby, and that baby is privacy and how to get it back.
Exactly. That's a great way to put it.
And I, I can relate to that for sure. So what are some of the ways we can give everybody an overview of the different ways that their privacy is being invaded? Because I have to say, even for myself, this is a topic that I kind of ignored until very recently. And, you know, I think the with Europe's GDPR and the Cambridge Analytica scandal, and also constantly thinking about ways that creators can get paid and the what I hope is not the unsustainability of the ad-supported model, I started to get interested in it. So I'm just learning myself, what are the various ways that our privacy is being invaded?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that most people don't even stop to think about this because there's no reason to. Like, unless someone gets in your face and says, hey, you know, Facebook hoovers up untold amounts of data about you. They have the world's largest database of faces, for example. So I always use this extreme example. It was a friend of mine who used to work for the DOD, and he's one of those like doomsday preppers who is hoarding silver and lives, you know, he's got a bunker that goes on pretty deep underground over in Washington. And yet this guy who is completely off the grid is not only present within Facebook's facial recognition database, but they have what's called a shadow profile. So even though he doesn't actually have a presence on Facebook, Facebook has a unofficial presence of him or an unofficial representative of him and finds different ways to target him. And so I think like that's a bit of an extreme case, but we really have this situation where...
So would you, do you have an example? How does he know that there's this shadow profile and he's being targeted from that information?
Oh, yeah. So he'll see different things on his phone related to... Because Facebook, what people don't know is that it's part of a larger ad network. They're constantly buying and selling data that could be used for different networks. So if someone says something about you on Facebook and they could tie it then to that shadow profile, which would then share and sell its information to another data broker. So the information entered about you on Facebook, even if you're not on Facebook, could be used to target you for different sets of advertisements.
Okay, so there's these shadow profiles. I mean, this sounds like it's similar to, I guess, the credit reporting bureaus in that there can be this profile about you with all this information aggregated from a lot of different places, and you haven't given any permission for that to exist, and there's not really any recourse for it.
Well, the only difference is that we've technically given permission for Facebook and Google and Amazon to do all that. The issue is that there's a term called a contract by adhesion, which basically means when you use the terms of service and you agree to it, it's completely lopsided. Like it's either you use the service and you agree to all these terms or good luck and you can't use it. You know, we'll shut you out. So you have to agree to it in order to go ahead to the next step. So in a technical sense, we do agree to Facebook doing all that. We're not aware of it. And it's not in their best interest to make us aware of it because for them, they know that most people don't read the terms of service. There's been a number of studies that have come out from a variety of different sources that have pointed out that people don't bother to look at what's in the terms of service. And the terms of service is designed deliberately to not be accessible. It's designed in such a way that we know you're not going to read it. That's why it's you know, three times longer than the Bible. And it's written in like this dense legalese to deter people from actually going through and reading it. So we do kind of agree to it. We're not fully aware of what we're agreeing to.
Well, in the case of your friend who has the Facebook shadow profile, is his agreeing to it because he has a Yahoo Mail account and somewhere in the terms of service it says, oh, we share data with partners, and partners means Facebook is one of them? Or?
Yeah, that's right. Facebook is constantly buying information from different data brokers like Experian and Axiom and a few different other ones. And so it's entirely possible that even if you don't use Facebook, they've purchased data about you and have it, and they're utilizing it in one way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of cross-referencing of this data going on. You might think that you're just using one service, but they're all sharing data and talking to one another.
Yeah, it's the process is actually extraordinarily difficult to weed through and understand, but it's almost like on a microsecond to microsecond level, there's information about you that's being transported and shared. When you go into Chrome and you refresh your browser, for example, like it's not just the website that's loading. There could be at least 20 to upwards of like 700 different things that are also loading in the background that are either installed on their site or installed in the browser and installed in an extension you installed, that are also collecting and gathering the information on you. And all of those things together are trading at a very quick level and sharing and gathering information.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess my initial reaction when I learned about these things and that some of the listeners might be thinking of is, oh, well, doesn't all this data that is being collected actually just serve me way better and more relevant ads?
It should. It doesn't. the web advertising model is for the most part completely busted. I'm of the opinion that in the ad-supported web model in general, it won't sustain itself. The only reason why it still exists to this day is because advertising agencies take advantage of the greed of Facebook and Google, and they know that they can overcharge companies to then put that money into Google and Facebook's advertising budgets. That's really the only reason why we still have the system that we have.
And so, you know, what about these ideas like big data and artificial intelligence? They're taking all this data and they're bringing us really relevant ads or making our services way better. I mean, isn't that kind of what all this tracking is for as well?
Well, I haven't seen that. Have you? You know, that's always what I tell people. The example I use in the book is that let's say you go to your grandmother's house and you're logged into your account for whatever reason, and you're searching for a washing machine because she has one that's broken. And then over the course of the next year, you're just followed around for advertisements about washing machine. And so that's really the way that the model works these days. It's not as smart or as sophisticated as they'd like you to think. It's actually quite dumb. The issue with big data is that there's a term called garbage in, garbage out. And so it only knows what we tell it. And so we're constantly feeding it bad information, like this user was at their grandmother's house once in the past year and did a search for a washing machine. Therefore, everywhere they go on the web, they should then be followed with persistent advertisement telling them to buy a washing machine. I mean, that's sort of what we have. It's not terribly sophisticated for the sole reason that we don't want to pay people to sit there and parse the data and say, no, we shouldn't be targeting them with an advertisement about a washing machine. We should be targeting them about X, Y, and Z. There's no people involved. So we're entirely dependent on very dumb and very simplistic algorithms that only know what we tell them to serve up this information. So a lot of it's bad for that reason.
So if we're at our grandma's house and we search for a washing machine, they end up serving up ads or maybe even sending mail to our grandmother about washing machines. How do they know that what house we're at?
So you're constantly broadcasting your location from a number of different devices. I mean, Chrome and my MacBook, for example, right now have an IP address that says Monroe, New York. And so just from using the laptop, it's easy to gain my location in upstate New York. And if you've got your phone is even worse because not only is your phone operating system tracking your location, but so is a ton of different applications on there. The example I always give people is, did you ever notice how Google Maps knows how much traffic there is around you? And the reason why is because Google Maps is constantly pinging your location and looking at the location of everyone else that also has Google Maps installed. And that's how they figured out the flow of traffic in your general area. So finding someone's location is very easy. It's one of probably the easiest bits of data that gets picked up first in all this hoovering.
And so then is this cross-referenced with other services? Like in the case of, I don't know, maybe that's an extreme example. Is grandma going to get actual physical mail with washing machines in it because you search for washing machines on your mobile phone at her house?
She could. It's not likely. What's happening with the direct mail business is kind of backwards still, and that's a good thing. So they haven't quite figured out that, you know, they can cross-reference the material, then send you direct mail. Some companies like Target do this to varying results. You know, there was that misnomer that came out. There was a Charles Duhigg book. I can't think of the name of it. Oh, The Power of Habit, I think it was, mm-hmm. where he talks about Target and accidentally revealing that this individual was pregnant through the data they've collected. That's actually proven to be false over the years, that they can't quite do that. So they haven't quite gotten to the point where they're sending you direct mail, but what they can do very easily is gather up information from that session at your grandmother's house when you were logged in, and then send that to a bunch of different third-party providers like Axiom and Facebook and Experian, and then target you online. So It's mostly online that we're talking about. Hopefully we don't get to a day and age where you're getting spam in the mail. I'd like to think that they will remain unsophisticated just by nature of that business. But with the way things are going, you never know.
And a lot of us on this podcast are business owners. And so we sometimes purchase advertising. And so are you kind of saying that a lot of the ad tech that is out there, like, say, for example, Facebook ads. Facebook ads are so hot right now. Everybody's trying to run Facebook ads for their business. Isn't it the best targeted ads you can possibly have because of this invasion of privacy?
So I want to say no flat out. I always want to give people the answer of no, period, full stop.
Sure.
But how it basically works is like the example used in privacy and how we get it back is the old Louis Black routine, where he talks about if he goes to Vegas, he doesn't play the slot machines. What he does is he gets a bunch of quarters and he starts to flush them down his toilet in the hotel room. Sooner or later, you know, the toilet's going to back up and he's a winner. And he probably has better odds of that happening than he does like winning on the floor in Vegas. And that's sort of how I describe Facebook ads. It's not that they don't work. They can be very good on if we're talking about like the top of the sales funnel, in a purely generating awareness stage of the product, it can be quite useful. But what happens is, especially if you're a small business, you start to run into this question of, is there a better, faster, and less creepy way to gain these exact same users? And I would say yes. And so I think if you're a huge brand and you're an enterprise level company where you have over like 1,000 employees and multi-million dollar marketing budgets, then if you're launching a new product, then Facebook ads doesn't hurt in any sort of way, but it's not what I would recommend small businesses or people below that level go and do.
Yeah. And having run some Facebook ads here and there, I do okay with the ones that are kind of retargeting, like this person clearly is interested in this product. But generally I am losing money on Facebook ads that I try. And it sounds like a lot of the business owners I talk to are the same way. So, I mean, is this all, is the whole ad tech business kind of just, a scam? Like like buzzwords about here's all this data that we have and we have this magic stuff that we can do. But ultimately, is it going to work?
Yeah, I mean, you have to consider first that most, I think it's about 60%, and that's probably on the low side. Most traffic that travels across the web is not human. It's bots, it's humans that are participating in some sort of fraud like a click farm. So right off the bat, you know, when you talk about people clicking on Google AdWords or clicking on Facebook ads, you have to factor in, okay, how much of this traffic is actually legit? You know, like how much of it is actually people that are in my area. So there's like billions of dollars that exists in ad fraud and waste just because there's no, it's not in the best interests of any of these companies to actively police for that. So that's on one end. And so on the other end, you've got, there's this sickness that we have, particularly in Western society, of wanting to quantify and measure everything. And that came out of the 1890s when we had a lot of the corporations burst onto the scene, and they were like, all right, well, you know, we're all about scale and we want to be able to manufacture things quickly. And so it's all about analytics. And so we became obsessed with a lot of bogus analytics since the 1890s. And I think in a lot of ways, what the metrics that Facebook presents is just as bogus as some of the ad measurements that we had back then. The difference is that a lot of decisions are made by, I don't want anyone to get offended here, but a lot of decisions are made by people with MBAs, and people with MBAs like bullshit metrics to justify mostly, if you've read the book, Bullshit Jobs, to borrow their argument, a bullshit existence. And so you've got a lot of people who go, or were in charge of millions and millions of dollars in advertising, that go, you know what, I can quantify Facebook ads regardless of whether or not it's bullshit, and therefore we're going to continue to put money into this regardless of whether or not it's fraud. So you've got basically like this perfect storm that ad tech feeds into, that ad tech exists within. So yes, I mean, like, it's a very simplistic answer, but yes, a lot of ad tech is mostly fraud. Some of it does work. I don't want to sound like I'm writing it off, but you have to understand, like, these macro level things that go into it, where you have a lot of people that are justifying their existence and a lot of people that are justifying their multi-million dollar ad budget, because if they don't spend that money, they're not going to get it again. And then you've got Facebook and Google, who it's in their best interest not to, to get deep into the weeds on this and show you how it actually works. And so that's what leads to a lot of ad fraud. So yeah, I do think that this is really something that's propped up by greed and ignorance. So they will collapse. It's just not going to happen as fast as we'd like it to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're having all this data collected about us. It may or may not actually help bring us better ads, and it may or may not actually help businesses find customers better. But apparently, in your opinion, it's not sustainable. It's probably not going to continue on. But as far as the idea of our privacy being invaded, I'm sure that a lot of people think, like, well, what does it matter? I don't have anything to hide. I'm a good person. What sort of response do you have to those thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, Glenn Greenwald probably has the best answer about "I have nothing to hide." When he was doing a presentation, and he was sitting next to, he was on a panel, and the guy next to him says, "You know, I've got nothing to hide." And so Greenwald turns to him and goes, "All right, give me all your passwords. Like, let me log into your email. Let me log into everything that you've got on your computer." And I think what you'd find is it's not that people are doing anything illicit, but we all wear different faces over the course of any given day. You know, we've got our work face and we've got our public face and our private face and the face we have when we're with our friends and with our partners. And so it's more true that in different contexts, we don't want people to know certain things. In the book, I constantly make a joke about superheroine themed pornography and how that's a thing that I'm into, but you don't necessarily want your boss to know about that, or you don't necessarily want, like, the really conservative human resources people to find that out about you and then use that as a way to get rid of you or to penalize you in some way. And so it's not that we have things to hide necessarily, that we just have different information about us in different contexts where that information would not be very productive and useful for it to be found out. So that's always what I tell people. I think that on some root level, there is always something that we want to maybe not hide, but obscure for one way, shape, or form. So that's sort of the "I have nothing to hide." The other argument that, you know, it doesn't affect me, what do I care? You know, the big thing is the government does it. So if the government does it, so why should I care if Facebook does that? And I think it's a great question. I don't really have a good answer to it. I think that I'm more of the opinion that you should know this stuff is happening, and then what happens after that is sort of up to you. And so the position I take in the book is, you know, if Facebook and Google and Amazon and Microsoft and Apple can collect all this information and turn billions of dollars worth of profit off of this information, at the very least, don't you think you should get paid for it? And that's sort of the question that the book hinges on. Or put another way, don't you think that if Apple is sitting on $289 million, or it's probably more than that, but $289 million worth of taxes that they refuse to pay, don't you think at the very least, if they're going to benefit off of this information that you've quote unquote consented to, don't you think they should pay some of these taxes and help pay for things like schools and roads and taking care of the elderly and people that can't afford to take care of themselves? And so that's really the position I take. It's not a hard and fast, you know, what do I care if they use the data? It's more, well, if they're going to do it, well, why don't they do X, Y, and Z?
Mm-hmm. And you brought up Glenn Greenwald. Glenn Greenwald, of course, broke the story with Edward Snowden years back about what the NSA was doing with their spying program. So how does government spying tie into all of this? Is the government is I suppose, using some of these companies as resources to supplement their own spying?
All of them. There's a great documentary called Terms of Service May Apply. It was a few years ahead of its time. I think now what they talk about in the documentary is, you know, how the tech companies will publicly complain and say, you know, oh, well, it's terrible that the government's trying to get all this information from us. But then, they'll turn around and be like, oh, yeah, we'll give you whatever you want. So it's no problem. So it's pretty well documented that that's sort of the situation where the tech companies are complicit in handing over government information. They have something that we're seeing right now with Trump is that a lot of employees that work for Microsoft and Amazon are starting to say, you know, I don't feel comfortable giving all this information to ICE or the Department of Homeland Security. And so we're starting to see a more public acknowledgement from the tech employees, not necessarily the company, that talks about their role in providing information to the government. But I'm sort of a weirdo in the privacy space. Like, most privacy people you'll talk to are like, the government is bad and they shouldn't be collecting this information. And I'm more of the opinion that they've been collecting this information for longer than all of us have been alive, or at least all of us listening to this podcast. And so it's been happening before we've been born, and it's probably been happening after we're all dead. So the question really is this data collection useful? And what we found, at least historically speaking, is that the data collection is terrible at preventing things. So like 1920 was the first major terrorist attack that was committed on U.S. soil. It was a bunch of Italian anarchists, and it came during a time when we as the federal government had access to wiretaps and all the different information that was going across the telegraph. And then you fast forward to things like the Boston Marathon bombing and things like 9/11, where we had a tremendous amount of information in front of us that said something is coming involving, you know, planes, and we should, you know, even the Russians are telling us that we should reinforce the steel doors on the cockpits because there could be an attempt to hijack it, and us doing nothing with that data for one reason or another. So there's that side of the argument, but then there's the other side of the argument that because of the data collection, we're able to catch these people pretty quickly. So like the Boston Marathon bombing, even though we knew that these guys were dangerous actors, we weren't able to stop them for one reason or another, but we were able to quickly go, hey, I've got a file on that guy, and I know where he is, and we can catch him. And so to me, I don't take a position on the government collecting information for that reason. Certainly I have concerns, especially when it comes to civil liberties and using the information to crack down on protesters and like the Black Lives Matters movement. But on the greater whole, I sort of struggle with whether or not it's for good or evil that the government collects this information, whether or not we should stop them.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like if there's these ad tech businesses that are collecting all this data, and it's not that useful for ad tech, then the government would still be interested in keeping that industry going and keeping those companies going. So is that kind of what you're implying when you're talking about, say, maybe Apple not paying all of its taxes? Is that somehow they might be in cahoots with the government as far as, hey, we kind of want your data, so we'll look the other direction? Or does that happen? Is the government doing anything to bolster up this way of collecting data, even if it's not necessarily viable from a business standpoint?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's not conspiracy. It's fact that all of the big five or the four horsemen or whatever, however you want to describe the big five tech companies. Some people dispute whether or not Microsoft belongs up there. I think they do. So to me, it's five horsemen. They all have government contracts. Like they all have government contracts. And this is something that can be looked up. That's why I mentioned the Department of Homeland Security thing and ICE and what's happening with Trump right now, where we're seeing an actual acknowledgement of these contracts that occur. So yeah, it's certainly true that I think that the government is propping this industry up to a certain extent, which is bad news for the rest of us, because that myth continues that we can put money into it and that we can get results. And meanwhile, these companies like Palantir, that a lot of people don't know exists, but like almost entirely is funded by a contract they have with the CIA, where they're continuing to collect information and then sharing it with them through some pretty creepy stuff. So yeah, I do think that the government does prop this stuff up. And I do think that there might be some trade-off of, you know, if you publicly say, we're not going to help you crack the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone, but then all of a sudden a mysterious third party emerges and look at that, we got into the phone, which it's more or less an Apple employee, maybe we'll look the other way on you not paying your taxes. So yeah, I don't dispute that these things happen. I've had good conversations There's a speech on my website. If you go to bjmendelson.com on the speaking page, I was speaking to a group of government communicators, which involved members of the FBI, CIA, NSA. So I've had decent conversation with those people. I've been more or less, it's been implied that this is sort of how it works. People could sort of read into that what they will and sort of make their own decisions.
We're going to take a quick break. You've been hearing this for almost 6 months now. That is how long Skillshare has been a loyal sponsor of Love Your Work. I appreciate it so much, and I'm thrilled so many of you have enjoyed the special offer Skillshare has had for us. Now, the rest of you, what are you waiting for? Skillshare's contract with Love Your Work is running out, so go get this deal. By the way, Skillshare is an online learning platform with more than 18,000 classes in business, marketing, entrepreneurship, technology, and more. You can learn about SEO, sharpen your writing skills, boost your productivity. You can learn about just about anything. So while you still can, join the millions of students already on Skillshare today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. 99 cents. What can you get for 99 cents these days? Nothing except this deal. You really have no other choice of what you're going to do with your 99 cents. That's right. Skillshare is offering Love Your Work listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 18,000 classes for just 99 cents. To sign up for this, go to skillshare.com/loveyourwork. Again, go to skillshare.com/loveyourwork to start your 2 months now. Okay, it is a nightmare scenario, but it does happen every day. Imagine you lost all of the data on your computer. I know it's not fun to think about. Maybe your hard drive failed. Maybe your computer was stolen. What are you going to do? I personally get my peace of mind knowing that all of my data is backed up to Backblaze. I know I can access any document on my computer from anywhere in the world, even on a mobile device, because it is all backed up. I know that if I lose my data, Backblaze can have me up and running quickly. Backblaze gives you unlimited space and no file size restrictions. And if you don't have the time to download a terabyte of data to recover everything, Backblaze will FedEx a hard drive or a USB stick. If you send it back, you get a full refund for that drive. So imagine you lost all of your data. Now imagine you're a Backblaze customer. You're up and running like nothing ever happened within about 24 hours. That is an insurance plan well worth $5 a month. Backblaze is offering Love Your Work listeners a free, fully featured 15-day trial at backblaze.com/loveyourwork. I am so glad they're doing this because this is totally going to save somebody's butt. Get a 15-day free trial of Backblaze at backblaze.com/loveyourwork. So it sounds like you feel like there's an ad tech bubble, that kind of a day of reckoning perhaps is coming for that industry. What would need to happen for that to happen? And is there anything that we can do as individuals to make it so that our privacy isn't being invaded at such a rate for little gain?
Well, I mean, the good news is that GDPR now exists. It's not perfect. There's probably going to be at least 2 decades worth of litigation that are about to happen with GDPR before we can safely say that it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. I hope it happens much quicker than that, but it probably won't. I've talked to privacy offices around the world in Canada, New Zealand, Australia, here in the United States, to a lesser extent. I've talked to all the senators involved, of like the ones that question Zuckerberg. So the good news is that with GDPR, we have something that we can copy more or less across the world and say, you know, this is the privacy standard that we want. The bad news is that these companies are mostly American companies, and there's all sorts of loopholes. So for example, the second that GDPR activated, for many years, Facebook had an office in Ireland, and that office in Ireland was in charge of all of the data that was being collected for citizens of the European Union. And the second GDPR was activated, they turned around and said, oh no, we're moving that over to San Francisco. And so now the company that's in charge of collecting all the information about everyone in the European Union is now under American jurisdiction, not European Union jurisdiction. Therefore, GDPR doesn't quite comply. So, I mean, there's stuff like that we have to deal with. The good news is that on the local level, we're starting to see, and when I say local, I mean like city, municipal, I mean like New York City, Seattle. We're starting to see offices and laws coming onto the book saying, you know, in New York, data can't be used to discriminate. Like, we're investigating some redlining is a thing that used to exist where we would use data to segregate different groups of people. And now a lot of that's starting to happen again through the use of algorithms and big data. So New York City on the local level said, this is not okay. We're investigating it. And if we're finding that you've been discriminated against because of the use of an algorithm, there is action you can take. And over in Seattle, they have what I call a privacy czar, but it's actually like an office for city level privacy data and collection, and what companies like Amazon, because they're based in Seattle, do with your information while they're based in the city. So if you want to do something about it, it has to happen on the local level. It has to happen city and statewide. The federal government is at least at this point in time completely broken when it comes to any sort of action being taken. And I think now with a more conservative Supreme Court justice being most likely appointed in the not too distant future, we're not going to see the kind of action that we need taken on the Supreme Court level. So if you're listening to this and you're like, something needs to happen, it has to happen on a local and city level. And so that those are the people to talk to. Those are the people to pick up the phone and hassle. It's not your senator or congressman or congresswoman. It's your local mayor. You know, it's your local city council. And we are seeing that things can be, you know, action can be taken. It's just people have to take that extra step and make it happen.
Mm-hmm. So as I said earlier, GDPR was one of those things that made me think about this topic a little bit more. And as an online business owner, I found it really annoying at first. But the more that I looked into it, and I had to change a couple things. It wasn't super difficult. But the more I looked into it, the more I thought, oh, this is actually a good thing. This is kind of preventing a lot of the stuff that I refused to do in the first place. And it would be nice if this would extend a little bit further. So I think along with that, and along with the Cambridge Analytica scandal with Facebook, it sounds like there's a little more awareness going on with consumers regarding this stuff. So from a consumer standpoint, outside of working with government, are there going to be implications you think of increased awareness?
Yeah, I think people are, what we've seen in Pew studies is that people are aware there's some kind of trade-off when they use these platforms. They don't necessarily know the extent of it, but they do understand the basics of, if I use Facebook, Facebook is going to creep on me, which is why you see that popular meme that Facebook is listening to your phone conversations. So yeah, the reason why that travels so well is because on a deep fundamental level, people believe, or they understand that they're giving up X, Y, and Z in order to use Facebook. So I think there's certainly awareness. Just by the way, Facebook isn't listening your phone conversations. They have the tech to do so. What's more likely is that there's a different app, or maybe it's even your operating system that's listening to you and then sharing that information through a third-party ad provider that is surfacing advertisements on Facebook. And that's why that happens. So, these things are certainly happening. There's certainly awareness of it. I think that with GDPR and the consumer level, the companies, even though they're trying to skirt regulation, they are starting to tighten the ship a bit. So, for example, would be what happened with Cambridge Analytica. I hate using the term growth hacking. I'm going to barf a little in my mouth using the term growth hacking. But what Cambridge Analytica was doing was nothing new. Between 2013, just to play it safe, and like 2017, there was this phenomenon with tech companies called growth hacking, where everybody was uploading your address book and spamming the people in your address
book. By the way, on this podcast, I have an article called Growth Hacking for Assholes. So
great.
Regular listeners are familiar.
Yes, so that's perfect. So that's exactly what I'm talking about. So Cambridge Analytica didn't do anything unusual. They were doing what everyone was doing, where they were just Facebook and eBay and every tech company, it's in their best interest. I mentioned eBay because you can buy fake traffic on there. It's in their best interest to more or less turn a blind eye to what's going on, because they don't want to pay for employees to police this stuff. So it was a little bit like the Wild West when it came to your data between 2013 and 2017. And so Facebook is now finally, you know, more or less said, this is, you can't do this. Like Apple just in the past month has made a rule in the store, in the App Store, saying if your app uploads people's contact address books, we will not put your stuff for sale. And so on the consumer level, we're starting to see a little bit of a crackdown. I think that these things are certainly good, but I think that the real crackdown is still coming. I think the real crackdown is going to come when there's a DOJ investigation, like Google went through a couple times, or what Facebook went through back in 2011. And then that's where you'll see real wholesale changes. And whether that happens anytime soon, I don't think so, because I think Trump will get reelected. So it's not going to happen anytime soon, unfortunately. But you know, I think that the consumers are pissed at the very least. And I think that maybe on the congressional level, we'll see some kind of translation of people are pissed and therefore we'll get some government action. But that's really what it comes down to. I think if we're going to see any real change, it has to come on the government level for it to be meaningful for consumers.
Yeah, intuitively, I agree with your assessment of the Cambridge Analytica scandal. I learned a little bit about it, and it sounded to me like this is probably pretty standard stuff in most political campaigns, or a lot of companies probably operate that way as well. So we've talked a little bit about working with the government. We've talked a little bit about consumer awareness, maybe pressuring companies to in order to put on a nice PR face to come up with these policies, such as Apple's policy of not allowing people to upload the address book. What about voting with your dollars? Is there, you know, if you think of being a consumer as voting with your dollars to further your values, are there any ways that a person can make decisions in that way?
Well, I think what's great, it seems that I don't like buzzwords like millennial or like Gen Z, because I really struggle with the definition of millennial. Technically, I am one, but someone 10 years younger than me is also a millennial and has like a completely different experience. So that aside, what's called nauseatingly Gen Z and younger, they seem to have no problem paying for stuff on the internet, where with my generation and older, we were part of that big lie of information wants to be free and everything should be free and why are you paying for stuff and that's stupid. And so there's a little bit of a battle taking place where the older generation seems a little more reluctant to pay for things, but the younger generation very much is, you know, voting with their wallet, where they're saying, oh, well, if I want the New York Times, I should pay for the New York Times. You know, if I want The Athletic, I'm a subscriber to The Athletic because they have a Buffalo section and I'm a big Buffalo sports fan. So, you know, I have no problem paying them $4 a month as a subscription. So we're starting to see that with younger generations of the willingness to pay for content. It hasn't happened in mass yet, unfortunately. I think people sometimes forget that baby boomers still represent a very large, very, very large demographic, and they've been lied to. You know, they for years believed everything that the Jeff Jarvises and Gary Vaynerchuks and Seth Godin's of the world have said, you know, the internet should be free and information wants to be free. And so getting them to pay for things is a little tricky, and getting them to vote for their wallet is a little tricky. But I'm highly optimistic with the younger generation that they pay for apps, they pay for Spotify, they will pay for content. We just have to give them a model that's fast and efficient, because right now it's not, you know, it's not easy. If you're a solo creator, you know, you have Patreon. I know you use it. I just started using it after years and years of resistance. I finally caved and said, all right, well, I'm going to have to do something.
I resisted as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard.
But I'm glad I did it.
And yeah, that's what I found, is that there was that initial, you know, I really don't want to ask people for money, because we've been told nobody wants to pay for their stuff. But now that we've got this younger generation that's coming up, they have that willingness, and I think it's okay to move into that model. But the thing is that there's not, until Brave and the basic attention token or something like it is embedded in everyone's browser, we're not quite there where it's as easy to pay for something that is than not pay for something. But I think we'll get there, and then when that happens, you'll see sort of the shift.
And can you expand a little bit on the reference to Brave, for anybody not familiar?
So Brave is this wonderful project by the co-creator Mozilla and a number of other very smart people that they're basically inventing a browser that's sort of like when Mozilla first came out, you know, when Netscape, before it died, more or less. They put all their code out, and that's where Firefox came from. That's where Mozilla came from. So it's a brand new browser that has a twist to it where there is absolutely no advertising or third-party tracking. Everything is blocked out. And what they're attempting to do through the use of the basic attention token, which is a cryptocurrency, where they would basically act like a third-party provider, where like if someone like me, because I'm registered within the database of, you know, approved vendors for the basic attention token, if you went to my site using Brave and you spent time on there, you can either A, tip me a small amount of basic attention token through the Brave browser, or you can pay based on the amount of time that you've spent on my site or the amount of time that you continue to come to my site. So it allows for a very seamless transaction to take place between the user and the person on the other side, the content creator, to compensate them. And more excitingly, because I think the Brave browser is the test case, and I think they'll tell you that. I think the real money shot is getting that back end installed into Firefox or getting that back end into Chrome and some of the other bigger browsers where you're able to make that transaction pretty seamlessly. And so that's the basic attention token and the Brave project in a nutshell. They have a great explainer video on their site. I think it's just brave.com if people want to go and see that.
Yeah, and I believe I might be registered on Brave as well. So if anybody goes to Katavi.net and they're using Brave and they have the tokens that they're distributing, then I'll supposedly get some of that. I've yet to get a payment from them, but it is a little bit like a Netflix for the internet in that, one of the things that prevents us from paying creators that we get information from is there's so many of them. But if we're paying one little bit every month and that's getting distributed bit by bit, like they're doing with Brave, then it starts to make a little bit more sense, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a good example. So I'm a pro wrestling fan, and for me to support an individual pro wrestler, they might have merchandise on sale. In order to buy the merchandise, I got to go to one third-party vendor, or they might sell you something through, like they might sell autographs through PayPal, but then they also have the Patreon and then on and on and on. Like they might have Buy Me a Coffee. There's no one simple way to give them money. It's not as easy to, like when you browse the web for free, someone is getting paid that someone is not you, right? Like the infrastructure is in place for billions of dollars to seamlessly transact across a variety of networks. But there is no network in place just yet where I can just go to that professional wrestler and say, I would like to pay you in basic attention token for some of your merchandise, or I'd like to buy tickets from you because sometimes they get compensated for ticket sales for this event coming up. And just being able to do the transaction through one person and through one provider that's not shitty like PayPal would be wonderful. And I think we're getting there. We're not quite there yet, but we are getting there. And so that's sort of the issue right now, is there's no seamless transaction taking place.
And I'm glad that you brought up Brave, because as we're having this conversation, I'm working on setting up a conversation with somebody from Brave. So people who are listening, look out for that episode soon. So do you think, since to have a different model, somebody's got to get paid, is there going to be a paid version of Facebook at some point?
Yeah, this is something I've advocated for. I tell people, if you pay for Netflix, you can pay for Facebook. How it should work is you should have the option though. Like I said, most people acknowledge that when they use Facebook, they give something up. If you're okay with that, fine. I have as long as you are consenting as an adult to that transaction with Facebook, I have no problem with that. But I would very much like the option to, even if it's like $8-9 a month. I know Sheryl Sandberg was out there saying it would cost something ridiculous, like $48 a month. Please don't listen to Sheryl Sandberg. She has a long history of making like false statements when it comes to Facebook. Like, for example, every small business in America should have a Facebook page, which is something she said in 2008, just before they started making you pay to reach the people on that wonderful Facebook page. So I know she's been out there saying it's going to be really expensive if you have to pay for Facebook, because she's trying to scare people off. But realistically, like if it's $9 a month, I will pay $9 a month. I know a large enough contingent of people will do it, to the point of just not being creeped on. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's a lot of people who just don't want to use Facebook for that very reason. So
yeah, I mean, that's true as well. And under GDPR, I mean, you can opt out of Facebook's data collection if you're a member of the European Union. You can use Facebook and tell them, I don't want you collecting my stuff, or after 30 days, I want you to delete my stuff. That's one of the nice things about GDPR that I'd like to see over here in the United States. I think people forget, like when Facebook, and this is true for any platform when it first launches, they are at their height in terms of usefulness when they first launch. Like there's an actual network of people that want to be on there. Like Facebook ads back when Facebook was college only were great. Like back then, if you said to me, should I put money into Facebook advertising? I would tell you resoundingly yes. So there is certainly like a contingent of people like me that remember when Facebook was a more closed experience where the ads were actually quite useful because they didn't have all this bullshit ad tech. I think a lot of people don't realize Facebook didn't have a business model until just after it went public. Like it's insane, but they did not have a business model. The ad thing that you see created, this was documented in a great book called Chaos Monkeys. The ad system that's in place on Facebook was bolted on. It was never something that was part of the original Facebook. So being able to pay just to use Facebook back in almost like its original setting, I think would be incredibly useful, both from an advertising perspective, because then people want to be there. You know, they're paying because they're saying, I want to be on Facebook. This platform has value to me. And I think that would allow for the advertisements to increase in value. But just giving someone that option, I think, would be a great start. We're getting there. Like I said, they announced not long after Zuckerberg was grilled before Congress, about 2 weeks later, they announced that they were investigating the use of cryptocurrency within the Facebook platform. So I think that's their way of signaling. They're very much aware of Brave and the basic attention token because it's made a lot of noise to the right people. And so I think that they're starting to go, okay, can we have a system where we compensate you for your data, or can we have a system where you pay? And if so, could we use the cryptocurrency in some ways, in the same way that the basic attention token and Brave work? So, you know, a lot of what we're talking about here, I think in the next year or so, we're going to see come to fruition. It's just that we're not there yet.
And regular listeners will also remember that I spoke to Steemit CEO Ned Scott, and their ears are probably perking up as they hear of Facebook announcing having a blockchain and using cryptocurrency, because that's something that we've talked that's about right. before on the show.
So that's a coincidence.
Yeah, it's funny how that works. Yeah, there's all these wonderful tech products that you aren't even given an option to pay for, and you're having your privacy invaded because of it. Are there any proactive measures you can take on your own computer or the way that what services you use to protect your own privacy?
The short answer is yes. The long answer is that yes, with the pretty big asterisk next to it. First, I found in most presentations that I've delivered so far that people are interested. I have the full privacy presentation up on my website on the speaking page, so people can go check that out at bjmendelson.com. I found that most people don't understand Tor or the use of VPNs or something like Telegram or Signal. So,
just to preface that, I have a pretty technical audience, so lot of them are going to understand. Not
Excellent.
Everybody is going to understand it, but I think you can get a little into that.
Okay, that is a relief, because more often than not, I'll talk about Tor and I'll see people just look at me like I'm crazy. So yes, there are
things. But Tor is actually not that difficult. You just download it. It's a little slower to get started from what I've experienced. I'm wondering, I don't know where it trips people up.
So I have this saying in my first book, which is common sense isn't so common. And so what is simple for you, me, and everyone listening to this podcast is not going to be simple to like a 60-year-old baby boomer, you know, who maybe has just now mastered Chrome. And I know that, again, like it seems easy to us, but that's the thing that I always try to remind people of, is that you have a whole lot of people out there who will buy a book like The New Rules of Marketing and PR and think that that's the greatest marketing book ever read, that's ever written. And realize about 200 pages in that he basically says nothing other than SEO marketing is great. But that's okay, because that book isn't written for that person. That book is written for the millions of people who don't understand that you can use Ghostory or I use Privacy Badger or HTTPS Everywhere or tools like that. So that's what I would say to that. Like, even though it's simple to us, it's not so simple.
So Privacy Badger, is that a Chrome extension?
Yes. So I'm a big, I sometimes disagree with them, but I'm a big backer of the EFF. Sometimes the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is a little too obsessed with what the government does and doesn't do. And I'm more focused on what the private companies do. So they offer some wonderful tools like HTTPS Everywhere is exactly as it sounds. It ensures a secure connection with pretty much anything that you use within your browser.
And to expand upon that, if you're connecting to a site with HTTP, not HTTPS, it's possible for somebody to see all of your traffic.
That's right. And so Privacy Manager, I used to use AdBlock Plus, but AdBlock Plus was doing some shady stuff. They've since backed off of that shady stuff. But for that reason, I felt like I had to use something like Privacy Manager, which basically does the same thing. And it shows you all the different trackers that are following you around. And it blocks most of them, not all of them, because it's always a bit of a cat and mouse game between, Privacy Manager is blocking this today, but tomorrow someone's going to have the workaround. I use Telegram quite a bit. Telegram is set up by a not-for-profit group to allow for secure end-to-end connections. It also allows you to destroy messages that are sent through Telegram. So it's quite good.
So Telegram is a messaging app.
Yes, so Telegram is a great privacy messaging app. For those of you in the crypto space, you definitely know what Telegram is because everyone uses it. My day job right now, I'm working with a cryptocurrency, and we use Telegram pretty heavily for that reason because Telegram has become like the messaging app du jour in the crypto space. So there's apps like that. There are things like Signal that also allow for end-to-end encrypted messaging. So yeah, and the short answer is yes, there is a lot. Especially if you're more technically minded, that you can do to protect yourself. None of these things are perfect. Tor has been broken. I think a lot of people forget that Tor was funded in part by the Department of Defense. At least that's where they got their initial funding. And it's been proven that there are some holes in it that the FBI, for example, knows how to exploit. So none of the things I've mentioned none of them are foolproof. Like even Telegram is not foolproof. But if you look at, you have to look at things on a spectrum, right? So the question is, is this more secure to communicate with someone than Chrome? The answer is abso-fucking-lutely. So Tor is way more secure than Chrome. But then there's that question of, all right, well, how secure is it? And then you kind of get into the weeds of it. So I kind of tend towards, if we're looking at this on spectrum, I'm in the middle. And I would tell people to that's probably your sweet spot of, these things are better than what we have, but they're not perfect.
Mm-hmm. And Signal is a messaging app. I believe WhatsApp uses the same technology as Signal, but obviously WhatsApp is owned by Facebook.
Yes.
So they're probably sharing a little something, but it's end-to-end encrypted, but they can see who you're messaging, but I assume they don't have the keys to decrypt your messages.
That's right. WhatsApp, I know they make a lot of noise about being secure, and I know it's very popular overseas. And I've used it when I've traveled overseas to do presentations. But Signal is much more secure for the reason. And Telegram too, for the reason that's not owned by Facebook, because Facebook for years has lied to the public. So when they or Instagram or one of their divisions tells you that something is secure, you really have to take it with a grain of salt.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's so much more that we could go into regarding this, but we will save that for another time. BJ, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really recommend anybody who found this conversation interesting, get Privacy and How to Get It Back. Where can they get that book?
Oh, so it's at yourprivacybook.com. It's available online at most booksellers. You can get it on Amazon for $10, as much as buying something on Amazon might be a little backwards when you're buying a privacy book, but that's the easiest place to get it. If you go to my website, bjmendelson.com, I have my phone number on there. Yes, it's my actual phone number. And if you text me the word sheetrock, it's spelled exactly as it sounds. Sheet as in sheet of paper, rock as in rock. I will send you a free PDF copy of my first book, Social Media is Bullshit. So definitely check it out, and I hope people enjoy it. And like I said, I have a full privacy presentation also up on bjmendelson.com on the speaking page.
Great. Now, sheetrock, one word or two words?
One word. All one word, sheetrock.
All right, great. BJ, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Is Love Your Work helping you find the intersection on your love and money Venn diagram? Does it bring you the inspiration and motivation to make you into the person that you want to be? If so, we, together, you and I, can make this the show that we want it to be. I'm trying to make a nourishing and thoughtful show, and I could use your help with that. please donate to the show. Just a coffee a month will help support the hosting and production of this show. Just a coffee a month will help spread Love Your Work's message, helping more people live a balanced life with a healthy definition of success. To donate, visit our Patreon page at kadavy.net/donate. Patreon is a platform that lets you support creators like me, vote with your dollars, and keep Love Your Work going at kadavy.net/donate. As a thank you, you'll get early access, bonus content, and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at kadavy.net/donate. That's kadavy.net/donate. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by our Patreon supporters, such as mini sponsor Roxana Maynard of Agility Alchemist at agilityalchemist.com, and top supporters such as Jeffrey Mason and Vitas Pankovicius. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Kadavy. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Durena from the album About Everything and More by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Kadavy, Inc.